It is, for the record, 5:18, and the following members are present. My co-chair, Representative Covert, Representative Nagyak, and Representative Tallarico. We have a quorum to conduct business. First today up is House Bill 363, the version 29-LS15433/A. A is an apple. Title, extending exemption for small power plants, and it's sponsored by myself. And yes, Representative Nagyak.
Is it 433? Mine says 1533.
Okay, hold on.
Yeah.
Yes. I stand corrected. Thank you, Representative. Thank you.
I was confused.
Sorry. So the version is 29-LS1533/A, A as in apple. Matt Dean, staff from my office, will speak to the bill. And I will hand over the gavel to my co-chair, Representative Covert. And thank you for attending the hearing.
Okay, please announce your name for the record and your affiliation.
For the record, my name is Matt Dean. I'm staff for Representative Liz Vasquez, and I'm here to present House Bill 363, extending exemption for small power plants. I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good evening to the members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you today. The purpose of HB 363 is to extend the sunset date of Alaska Statute 42.05.711R to January 1, 2025. The idea behind this is to encourage the continued exploration of renewable resources, private investment into the use of renewable resources to produce power, and lower the barrier costs of entry into power production. In order to qualify for the exemption outlined in HB 363, interested parties must produce power from renewable resources, produce 65 megawatts or less per year, sell their power exclusively to RCA-regulated utilities, and must not have received any form of grant or tax credit that encourages the use of renewable resources. We've received a large amount of support for the bill from the renewable energy sector, and I'd like to point out that there is, in fact, a zero fiscal note associated with the bill. I'm here to answer any questions, if there are any, from the committee.
Any questions of the sponsor from the committee? Madam Chair, as the sponsor of the bill, you have anything else you would like to add?
No, I just wholeheartedly support this bill. I think it encourages the more energy production, especially renewable energy production. It encourages that type of activity, and which is very welcome in this state.
Thank you. Just for those online and those present, just a housekeeping measure. House Bill 187 is calendared today. We were expecting to get a committee substitute that hasn't been drafted yet. If there's anybody that wanted to speak to that that came or is online for that purpose, we will take your testimony later after we deal with this bill. But otherwise, we'll be having another meeting on Friday at 5 p.m. to deal with House Bill 187. Anything further to add, Madam Chair?
Representative Culver, I would just, if there's anybody that wishes to testify in HB 187, I encourage that they first see the new CS before they testify. It's because they're...
Okay. As soon as then, Madam Chair, we'll when that CS is available, we'll put that up on basis tomorrow, and so folks can be prepared for Friday on that issue. So back to 363, let the record reflect that Representative Klayman joined us at 5:20. Thank you, Matt. I think we'll open up public testimony on House Bill 363. And present in the room, we have Duff Mitchell. Duff, would you like to approach?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Duff Mitchell. I'm the executive director. I'm speaking today as the executive director of the Alaska Independent Power Producers Association, and we fully support this bill. Previously, in 2010, this was a bill that was extended, and it sent a signal that the state was open for business and that we wouldn't be over-regulating small power producers. And as a result of this bill, or a result of the exemption change, a lot of people have become IPPs and have started to try to develop. There's also a very long lead time for developments with permitting. Hydropower takes 10 years. We're getting ours done in 6, but wind regimes, solar regimes, they take a long time to get permitted. This removes one level of regulation. Alaska is the only state that regulates anybody under 80 megawatts. And so this is a compromise previously at 65 megawatts. And so we don't see this as anything more than extending the sunset and not putting the state back any further, but this is just taking us forward. And with that, that's pretty much, it's a pretty simple bill. I appreciate any support.
Quick question, Mr. Mitchell. So you have a project in the queue that would benefit from deregulation, I guess, if you will?
Well, it's not really deregulation because there's a lot of other things I'd like to deregulate, but this is just one little item. Mr. Keith Comstock's here to speak with Juno Hydropower, but yes, we have a hydropower project that would fall in this bill.
Any other questions by the committee? Madam Co-Chair.
Yeah, Mr. Mitchell, just for the record, I know the answer, but it's good to have a good record established. This is consistent with federal statute, is it not?
It certainly is, Madam Chair. And I would just add, you asked about the queue. There was one Fishhook Renewable. They had to spend, they were very small hydropower, and they spent thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars, which was really unnecessary. That could have been spent maybe more for engineering and more for, you know, developing project as opposed to the regulatory world.
Okay, thank you.
Next,
we'll go online to Ethan Shutt, Siri. Ethan, would you like to testify?
Yes, I would. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and state your affiliation and name for the record, please.
Sure. My name is Ethan Shutt. I'm the Senior Vice President of Land and Energy Development at Siri and President of our wholly owned subsidiary, Firehound Wind. I appreciate the chance to call in and testify in support of House Bill 363. We view this as a simple extension of the sunset date of the prior legislation. We believe that this legislation is common sense. It encourages private business dollars to be invested in Alaska in modestly or small size renewable power projects. It does benefit the public, and it does not burden state government. It simply provides an easier and more certain path for project developers as far as the regulatory burden of obtaining either an exemption from or obtaining a CPCN from the RCA. Neither path is well-defined for an otherwise unregulated project. So we agree with the prior testimony that this is pretty simple legislation, easy to support, and Siri is fully in support of this legislation or this passage. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We do have two folks from the Regulatory Commission online if we have any of those technical issues that need to be answered. With that, we'll go back in the room to public testimony, Keith Comstock. If you'd like to testify, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Keith Comstock. I'm the President and CEO of Juno Hydropower, a private hydropower developer based here in Juneau, Alaska. We're fully committed to the independent power producer model, which basically, where basically private capital and private industry is used to develop an energy project. Our project is Sweetheart Creek Hydroelectric Power Project and the Juneau District Energy Project. We started this project in 2009, and we expect this summer to receive our final FERC license and our notice to proceed, our 404 permits, and with just a little bit of luck, because, you know, the feds kind of go at their own speed, and we've been waiting for quite a little while. A little bit of luck, we'll be in construction this fall. We would benefit from this regulation extension, but more importantly, I think having this regulation is very important to future projects because a lot of times decisions were made. In the case of our project, so far all of the money invested in the project has been local Alaska investment. But there's a lot of investment dollars that come from down south, places like New York, and anything like this that helps de-risk a project, dramatically increases the possibility that investment dollars will get unleashed in Alaska's favor. And so I applaud what you're doing. I think Madam Chair, I think it's a very, very helpful bill. And I believe that in combination with the recent clarifications from the R docket at the RCA, this bill in combination with that should help unleash some economic investment at a time when the state desperately needs it.
Thank you. Any questions by the committee? Can you maybe kind of just give us a thumbnail sketch of what financing looks like for your project?
Sure. So far, we've spent the last 6 years going through the regulatory situation, and that has all been privately funded. Basically, our next step, and once we're in receipt of a license to proceed, the FERC license and the preliminary permits, will be a combination of equity investment and loans. House Bill 143. Enables ADA to look at conduit bonds, which I thank you all for your vote on that. We appreciate that very much. Should be up in the Senate here shortly. That is one possible source of funding for us on the debt side. It's basically like, it's almost exactly like buying a house. At least it used to be like buying a house, back before they changed the rules, where, you've got to have a good job and pay stubs, and you've got to save some money and have some equity to put it down. And so, you basically have to come up with about a 20% down payment. You can borrow the rest, assuming that you can demonstrate your ability to pay the loan back. And so we feel very confident that we should be in construction just as soon as the feds give us the green light on the environmental.
Okay. How much transmission line do you have to build? How far are you away from the grid?
We're about 6 miles from the state-owned ADA transmission line facilities. So we'll have to about 6 miles of new transmission, some of that overland, some of that underwater.
What would be your output in the winter? Will you have a variable output on the project?
No. This particular project is more of a storage project. We have a 5.5 mile long lake. We'll be raising the lake 100 feet. So many hydro projects in Alaska produce a ton of power in the summer, and then they have problems with power production in the winter. This particular project was first identified by the federal government in 1906 for its hydropower potential. It's been studied at least 3 times by different folks, including the state and the feds, trying to bring it online. The issue, they got closest when the federal government decided to construct Snettisham.
Okay.
And so it was basically a choice between Snettisham and Sweetheart, and if I, as a private developer, had to make the same decision, I'd have built the bigger one too. But it's already built, so we're now next in the queue. The state got really close to building it when they were looking at building a pulp plant, in the facility as a source of energy for that. The conditions are now right, the market is right, but basically the way that this project has been designed is to store a lot of water, and so we'll basically run the facility at level operation, so it'll produce just as much power in the summer as it does in the winter. It's just that, during the summer we'll be accumulating water, and during the winter we'll be depleting water, but that's the point of the reservoir. So, think about this more as a storage project.
The marketing of you your energy, weren't you going to supply power to the Kensington mine, and then was it the heat loop in Juneau, that proposal?
Right. So about assuming that the Kensington stays at its current level, I know they're looking at expansion plans, but assuming they stay at their current level, about 60% of our output will be consumed by the Kensington. The balance of the power will go to the district energy, Juneau district energy.
Is that going to be with the same, the energy project, is that going to be with your same firm, or is that a different entity?
It's a subsidiary. It'll have slightly different ownership, but there's some common ownership. So it's for practical purposes, they're a control group. Emerson, which is a large corporation, has shown real interest in this being their marquee project for North America. So you know, we'll be the first seawater heat pump district energy project in North or South America. There are several in Europe. There's only one high heat project that's in Drammen, Norway. A second has been announced in Scotland, and so we'll be the third in the world who basically will heat a town with seawater.
Great. When's the projected startup on that, assuming everything goes ahead with your hydro project?
They'll be concurrent.
Concurrent, so you would start doing the build-out?
Yeah, so we'll build at the same time. And the object is to bring them both online at or near the same time.
Are those large heat exchangers that you use for that seawater conversion, are those off the shelf, or what is the technology and the engineering hurdles on that?
Emerson perfected their patents about 9 years ago through their subsidiary Vilter, which is a U.S. company based out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And so basically seawater heat pumps are these heat pumps. They're basically the same technology that runs your refrigerator, just on an industrial scale. And inside your refrigerator it's nice and cold, but on the backside you get a lot of heat out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can run a refrigerator one way and get chilling, and run it the other way and get heat. The difference is the secret sauce has been these advances in refrigerant technology and advances in metallurgy that basically allow higher pressures and higher heats. And so before the Ted Stevens facility and the Alaska Sea Life Center in Seward, they both use seawater heat pump systems to heat themselves, but they're using kind of the previous generation, which in lay terms is called a low heat system. And with a low heat system, it's perfect for new construction, but it has very little value in retrofitting, say, a building like this building, which is built basically for high heat. It's an oil-based system. It's using a boiler. And so with a high heat system, you know, should the state choose to participate, they can simply bypass their boiler and receive hot water directly from the facility, you know, through a heat exchanger. And so very, very low cost of conversion to existing facilities. And so that's the excitement about this project, because it basically before you'd have to basically rebuild the building in order to switch over. And so that was great if you were, you know, planning a new college campus or a new facility, but not very good.
At the point of where the boiler is, that would be another heat exchanger in the building where the seawater loop or your medium, whether it's a glycol or whatever you use.
Basically, hot water would come in. It would go through a heat exchanger. Of course, you know, if it's for a house, you know, the heat exchanger would set nicely on this table. If it's for something like this building, it might be the size of a big refrigerator. They're amazingly small. I would encourage you, if you haven't toured the Ted Stevens facility, to do so. It's just amazing at how little space these things actually take up. And so basically there would be a heat exchanger at the point of demarcation, and so basically with a BTU meter, and so basically hot heat would be being exchanged from one system to the other system. These systems are in, you know, the basic systems are in wide use in Europe. The difference is they're agnostic as to the heat source. I mean, you can build a district heating system with natural gas or coal or oil or seawater. or solar. You know, doesn't matter what the source is, but you know the advantage is that seawater heat pumps are so efficient that you know that it makes it very cost competitive. And without the cost competitiveness of a seawater heat pump system, with you know a reliable electricity supply, you know the project wouldn't be viable.
So I guess I got a couple questions on the just the logistics. How do you bill a consumer for that? Or let's say this is by a monthly contract? Is it by BTUs?
It's typically by BTUs. Right now you're paying, if you have electricity, you're paying by the kilowatt. Or if you have an oil system, you know, you have a big tank and they come out and fill up your tank and they send you a bill for the gallons. And so basically the European BTU meters are roughly the size of a kilowatt meter. You know, you attach it on the side of your house. All the modern ones are now internet enabled, so you know you don't have to send anybody out to read them necessarily. And basically, it's just capturing the BTUs that are transferred from one side of the plate to the other.
Okay.
And so, if you turn your thermostat up, you're going to eat more of them. If you turn it down, your bill will be cheap.
How far can a loop? What's the maximum distance? I mean, by a heat loop. So I imagine you have a number of loops. Different size piping and branching off. Sure. How far can you expand the network from the plant? And would then you build more than one plant? Or
that's a really good question. The technology to build the loop or to extend the loops is phenomenal. I mean, there are places in Europe that are extending these loops 30 miles. The issue becomes the cost justification. And so, you know, the reason why this project works so well in Juneau, and I can think of some other cities in Alaska that are on the water that could be viable, is when you have a densely compacted customer base. You know, the reality is, you know, there was no central planning for Juneau. Somebody found gold and boom, you know, here comes a city on the side of the hill with everybody kind of piled on top of each other. By the way, that's kind of how Europe was built too. And so anytime you have, you know, a compact, dense urban area, it's very cost effective for a district energy loop. And so typically speaking, a central loop of about 2 miles is kind of an ideal. Especially, you know, we've gone through the calculations. We've hired the leading district energy company in the world, which is Evergreen Energy, which is actually a subsidiary of the city of St. Paul, Minnesota. They've done the majority of district energy systems that have been constructed in the last 20 years. At today's very low oil prices, it makes sense for us to focus in on the downtown area with possible expansion to West Juneau, Douglas.
Mm-hmm.
And we've never taken a state, federal, or local dollar. We're not seeking any. It wouldn't probably make sense right now to go, say, to the hospital. We'd like to go to the hospital, but you know the cost of trenching in the pipe, you know, 6 or 7 miles, that's the main cost of this. The pipe's relatively cheap. There'd be very little heat loss. It would work just fine. It's just that it would take, you know, decades to recover the cost of extending it out any further. Of course, if, you know, we're all, as Alaskans, hoping that oil rebounds as quickly as possible, if it returns to a more normal level, you know, we certainly would look at expanding as much as we could.
Thank you, Mr. Kolstak. Representative Will has joined us, and Representative Will, we were just asking Mr. Kolstak about the Juneau seawater heat loop project. We're on 363, but he's got expertise in.
Yeah, and I know you guys want to go home at some point, but I stand up for the next 3 hours. You know, so I'm very passionate about this subject.
It's an exciting project. Yeah.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Madam Co-Chair?
Yeah, Mr. Kolstak, what is your projected time frame for finishing the project to take it to Kensington Mine?
2018, the same time frame. We basically, of course, that assumes that come July, the federal government keeps their word and gives us the permit, Johnny on the spot, like they said they would, and that we have a nice mild fall. So, you know, we're still holding to the 2018 date. And until further notice, it's, you know, we hope to be running the system online in 2018.
Go ahead.
Mr. Councilor, your project would replace what? The source of energy right now is what for Kensington?
Diesel. They burn between 7 and 9,000 gallons a day, more than both the city of Haines and Skagway combined.
Mm-hmm. And for the Juneau area, what will that replace? What
sort of energy? Again, diesel. I mean, the primary consumer for this product would be you know, somebody who's heating their home using a boiler system or a diesel heating system. 78% of the homes in Juneau are heated with diesel. So, yeah, we that's basically the, you know, it's a, you know, of course we're 100% green. There are no carbon emissions. You know, I'm not, you know, I want a lot of oil on that pipeline. Let's sell it to Japan, and let's cut our costs here local.
Awesome. Okay, any other further questions? Thank you, Mr. Comstock. And with that, anyone else wish to testify on House Bill 363 online or in the room? Hearing none, we'll close public testimony and open it up to discussion by the committee here. We're intending to move this bill out today, so anyone? No?
I guess...
Rep. Fingler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at this letter from the Alaska Power Association, and this sort of came to mind when I first read the bill. The first concern is there's 65 megawatt size, which is bigger than probably any power plant in Fairbanks. I don't know if any renewable... that just seems like a large... production facility not to be regulated, but maybe someone can speak to that.
Madam Co-Chair?
Mr. Representative Covert, can I have Mr. Matt Dean address that question?
Yes.
And perhaps someone wants to add to that, they can.
Once again, for the record, my name is Matt Dean, Staff Representative Liz Vasquez. The 65 megawatt was actually a deal struck in 2010 as a compromise between the number that was requested by some of the opposition at the time and the federal standard of 80 megawatts. Under federal standards, anything under 80 megawatts is already not regulated as it is. So it was basically just an agreement on terms.
Follow up?
Mr. Chairman, does anybody want to add to that explanation, Mr. Mitchell?
Yeah, I would just add that this bill is just an extension of the sunset that's going on. So there was that compromise done earlier, like you explained. But you know, it's very expensive. When we testified earlier, it's very expensive to go through the regulatory process. There may be a hydropower, I know that like Snowshams over 65, there may be new hydropowers, there may be some plants in the future that it's very unlikely that we will have those kind that are IPP driven rather than a state or some other agency driven. But the government, the federal government, has an 80 megawatt limitation, and so you know it's kind of like anything under 80 is exempt. We're just trying to get that further exemption, and the 65 was basically a previous, so we're just trying to keep that state overreach. But if you compare to federal standard, we're a little bit less, or we're more restrictive than what the federal government is.
Sure.
Yeah, Mr. Mitchell, can you go ahead and state your name for
I'm sorry, Duff Mitchell, Alaska Independent Power Producer Association.
Respond to that question. Representative Wolf.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Yeah, I guess 80 is the federal standard, and power plants and the federal lands in the lower 48 are, I'm sure, pretty big compared to the ones up here. I know that we do have a lot of power plants that have been recently produced, built in Alaska, and some people say we have too much power in certain areas. You know, like I said, the Healy 2 power plant that just went online and then unfortunately went offline, I think it's 50 megawatts, and that was a big deal. So 65 for Alaska is a bigger size power plant, I guess, which maybe not in, you know, St. Louis or Chicago, it's not very big, but up here, 65 is not a trivial.
I think we definitely need to keep in mind that this is all about strictly from renewable energy resources and won't cover coal, gas, oil, or any of those, just renewables. Mm-hmm. Which, and I hope, I know there's always been talk that the federal government doesn't necessarily consider hydro to be renewable. I think we do in the state of Alaska. So that
is correct.
Yeah, which is very bizarre to me. But
it's considered renewable, and for anything other than tax, I mean, they talk out of both. But it's not technically renewable.
Okay, Representative Nagyak.
I think that we were extending the bill to January 2025, so I guess it's been working for a while. So I think it's. And I think it's self-explanatory is working. It's, we're going to extend it and we'll become more renewable power.
Okay. Welcome, Representative Tilton has joined us. Any other further discussion? No. Questions?
Entirely.
Ready to move the bill then. Representative Tallarico, make a motion, please?
I can, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. I move House Bill number 363, version 29-LS1533/A from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
Hearing no objection, the bill moves from committee and we'll adjourn the meeting and stick around and we will sign the bill. Madam Chair, Co-Chair.
Thank you. I just want to thank Mr. Gassaway and Ms. Wilson for being on the line and available for any questioning. They're both from the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. With that, we're adjourned at 5:50.